Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. Well, we're only 2 weeks into the year and there's already been a series of global events unfold that have stirred emotions and had everyone hanging off the world news services for the next dramatic chapter. Australia has endured one of the worst bushfire seasons on record, with an unfathomable amount of bushland burned and animals destroyed. An Iranian general has been executed, potentially sparking a new Middle Eastern crisis. And the seemingly omnipresent US-China trade war has marched onwards. As a means to address our thoughts on these events and discuss their impacts on world markets, we have entitled this week's instalment, Christmas Crises, Missile Strikes, Bushfires and Trade Deals. I'm joined today by our Chief Strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith. G'day, David.
G'day, Tim.
Happy New Year to you.
And you. Good to be back and to the listeners.
And also our Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. G'day again, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
Fantastic. So what we'll do is we'll jump straight into the agenda today. So we're going to start by looking at the Australian bushfires, moving into Iran missiles and potentially World War III. We're then going to be looking at the US-China trade deal, some Chinese influence in Hong Kong and Taiwan, and then, of course, rounding out, as always, looking at how these themes impact the investments and the models we run every day here at Nucleus Wealth and the MB Fund. So with no further ado, let's jump into it. Who'd like to begin? Australian bushfires.
Oh, I'll go have a crack, I guess. So Aussie bushfires, maybe you want to do that one, actually, Damo, because I didn't write GDP effect versus economic effect.
Yeah, I think the main thing is, so there's been a lot of, there's a lot of discussion out there about, you know, is this a net positive economic thing because of the rebuild? And so there's this issue with a rebuild in terms of saying, well, what we call a broken window fallacy. If you break a window and then you fix it, that's great for GDP. But you're saying, well, it's not actually good economically. Like somebody's just gone and had to go and spend money and effort and bring somebody in to fix something that wasn't actually, you know, the net effect before versus after is still
just
have a window.
Replacements.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so...
it's Australia's favourite growth trick, that one.
Yeah, that's right.
That and population.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, that is what it is.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
You add more people and then... you know, try and catch up to where you were in terms of standards of living. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, and then you have and China's got a similar thing where, you know, they keep knocking down apartments to build new ones, and you're saying, well, if somebody had an apartment to live in enough before and afterwards, yeah, it's slightly newer, but you know, the actual economic effect on the economy in that are you progressing forward? So, so the GDP effect though, even the effect we think will come through from having to rebuild. Isn't as much as all the negatives, which we'll sort of get onto on the next some of the next points. I guess probably start with inflation. So there's food price inflation is certainly to come through. We've also had
this is a supply problem due to farmland burning
and animals culled and things like that and supply chains interrupted.
Yep.
So, so inflation in food prices is pretty certain to come through. There might be a bit of inflation in other areas of the economy that are sort of,
being squeezed.
Flow on effects.
Yep.
Yep. And what we're thinking, though, is that the RBA will very much look through those. Having said that, though, even if the RBA does look through it, or say they're going to look through it, there will be an element of will they do as much as what they should have done. So, for example, if there was no bushfires and we're sitting on 1.6% inflation, which is well below their target, that's sort of saying to the RBA they have to get out there and do more. If we're sitting on sort of 2.5% inflation, sort of dead in the middle of their target, they won't be raising rates because they'll be saying, well, we have to look through this inflation because... it's coming from the bushfires, but will they actually go out and spend more or go out and do other quantitative easing or whatever it is that they might not? So they'll look through it to justify not turning the ship around and starting to raise rates.
Yep.
But will they look through it enough to actually
stimulate
more?
Yep.
We suspect not.
Yeah,
given their past track record.
Yes, oh, well, I'll disagree with you. Yeah, I think they will.
Yep.
Yeah. It's about the jobs market rather than inflation.
Mm.
I mean, all indications are that unemployment's set to keep rising, particularly owing to the building bust.
Yep.
We'll get to whether we think that the fires will have any impact on that in a moment. Well, I should say now, I guess, 2,000 new homes or 2,000 homes lost, potentially replaced. It's very small. It's not likely to be material for any rebound in building.
Yeah, in local areas, it'll be big for some of those areas.
Yeah, sure.
But
not in aggregate.
In aggregate, yeah, that's right.
And, you know, the other sort of $3 billion or so earmarked for, you know, things like securing the power grid and what have you, that'll take time to roll out as well. And in the meantime, you know, there's a major engineering construction bust underway. You know, the infrastructure pipeline is still very big, but it's falling. It's not even stable. It's actually falling away. So, and, you know, there's no immediate turn coming in dwelling construction either. So, I mean, we think that the unemployment rate will continue to tick up. Well, I do. And I think that will trigger the RBA. It may not be in February. You know, they might take pause for a month or two.
Yeah.
But I still think that if unemployment continues to tick higher, they'll cut again.
Yeah, I'm not arguing they won't cut. I guess what I'm arguing is, look, I think they will cut twice. I haven't changed our views on that, and they'll start some QE later on in the year.
Yeah.
I'm just saying I don't think it'll be as big as it could have been if we didn't have the bushfires come through.
Yeah, possibly. I don't see it altering the trend and where they're going.
No.
It may play around with the timing a little.
Exactly. And I guess what I'm saying is it probably should. It probably should mean they should actually go earlier and go harder.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Because I think that what will hopefully become clear through this discussion, that I think the net outcome of the fires is negative.
Yes, absolutely.
Not positive.
On the economy or on markets?
On the economy.
Okay.
Yeah.
And GDP and markets.
Yeah. So the building boom, I guess we've more or less covered that. There isn't really much of one coming in terms of reparations. So, you know, and it's really fighting against this immense downdraft in dwelling construction that's got most of this year to run, if not into next year.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we see a turn in sales now, that won't be able to turn the trend in growth.
Yeah.
Up.
Well, I mean, for most of this anyway, if you decide tomorrow, if we get an insurance check tomorrow, which probably won't take tomorrow, it'll probably be more like a month or two, and say, right, you know, let's get my builder and start planning and doing all those things. You know, you're still talking a month or two, three, 4 months before you're breaking ground.
Yeah.
A lot of these.
And then meanwhile, you know, there's starting to get a bit of kind of anecdotal evidence that tourism has taken a pretty nasty hit. So far, the evidence suggests that it's more domestic tourism than it is international.
Yep.
Which probably in aggregate isn't negative either, I would have thought. Like, locals sort of cancel going to the bush.
Yeah, well,
because there's a fire, they might go somewhere else, or
they
might spend that money, or maybe they put it on the mortgage. I don't know. but I would have thought that they would just shift their holiday plans rather than necessarily not go.
Mm-hmm. And potentially foreign tourists would do the same, perhaps.
Well, the anecdotal evidence so far is that bookings for international haven't fallen much.
Okay.
But I guess that, you know, if you booked an international holiday, it's a big call to cancel that.
Mm.
It's a lot of money.
Mm.
I would have thought in the medium term it's more an issue.
Yep.
Like, just where you're contemplating going to Australia for a holiday, maybe in 6 months or 12. And then you've seen all of this, and there was immense sort of negative global coverage.
There was, it's made us all the way to the UFC.
Yeah, and you're planning on coming to Australia next summer.
Yeah.
And you might think, well, I'd hang back or go somewhere else. Do I really want to go and, you know, smoke 2 packs a day in Sydney or et cetera?
Might as well go to Beijing.
So I think that's probably the major concern in terms of impact. And then, there's also consumer confidence. You know, the initial, with these kind of shocks, generally you see, you know, kind of sticker shock with confidence drops markedly in there, but then bounces back really quick. On this one, I don't know. I think there could be more of a lingering effect, simply because the government has handled it so badly.
Yep.
And there's a real kind of tipping point feel to the whole thing for the Morrison government. They really botched it, and they still are. There's no real sense that they're getting on the front foot to address climate change or, for that matter, adaptation, etc., etc. You know, they're flopping around with everyone putting in their two bob's worth. There's no real leadership. So I think there might be a more lingering impact on consumer confidence, especially since households were already so grim and so stalled. I don't think this will do them any good. So, you know, international tourism and household spending or household consumption are probably likely to have a lingering negative.
Yep.
Another reason why I think the RBA probably should go harder and likely won't. And then, you know, you've got the ongoing drought, of course, which has been sucking slowly at GDP, and is also, I think, starting to have beyond the fires, starting to have a pretty negative impact, especially in New South Wales, around crises around water.
Absolutely. Towns running out of water.
Yep, and Sydney's water supply is down to like 43%, I think, and if that persists till mid-year, you know, we'll be getting down into the 30s pretty quick, and you know, the whole thing sort of starts to feel a bit end of days.
Yep.
Fires into drought into water shortage. You know, I think that's not going to help the consumer bounce out of its existing funk. I mean, another kind of interesting angle is, will it do anything to house prices? I mean, a bit of an unknown. I wouldn't have thought so necessarily. But again, if the consumer gets more grim, then probably a little bit.
Yeah, I saw something the other day. Fairly, it was given by a real estate agent saying that in the localised areas where fires generally are, you get a big push up in prices due to the fact that you get insurance policy payouts and people want to live around it. Now, it's so localised and so small, I think it would barely move the needle on a national level.
And the other thing I'd say in that is it goes from, you know, I have a 1950s fibro shack just burnt down and got a brand spanking new McMansion.
Yep.
So the land value hasn't changed at all. It possibly has gone down a little bit because of the bushfire.
Yep.
But the value of the house sitting on there is worth a lot more now.
Yeah, right. Yep. Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
Immigration, would it have an impact, do you think?
Or the margin? Yeah.
Might. I mean, there's a lot of immigration now from the subcontinent, and pollution may not necessarily be an issue, especially, and also for Chinese, I guess. Mind you, I mean, at least in the case of the Chinese, you know, the kind of bolt hole down under in a clean environment has been fairly central kind of incentive. So maybe on that front, it could be a bit of damage. I don't know if the same thing holds for the Indian community, which tends to be a bit further down the socioeconomic ladder, I think, than the Chinese migrants. So just a little bit of damage in each one of those, probably, and a little more lingering than usual, I would think. But I mean, it's very speculative.
And remembering as well,
we're just guessing.
We're only sort of halfway through, or three quarters of the way through, the actual Australian fire season, with Victoria known for February being the hot month.
Yeah, so. Well, at least we've had some rain.
Well, one day anyway.
Yeah.
A little bit of rain.
Very good. All right, we'll jump across to the next topic. But just before I do, I'll just let obviously our people, anyone listening in, know that the chat box is open for live questions along the way. We are shooting this live, and also for those listening in, we will be providing the slides in the link in the show notes on the podcast. So we'll jump across now to the Iran missiles and World War III. World War III getting bandied around a little bit recently on social media. Where would you like to begin?
That's drawing a very long bow, World War III.
Well,
a very, very long bow. But you know, we thought we'd put it up there for, because as you said, there's a bunch of people saying that, you know, that they think China and Russia are all ready to go to step in behind Iran to, and Maybe they are, but I think it seems unlikely.
Yeah. I mean, what have we got there? Limited impact on oil. Neither side wants war. I'm not sure that's true. probably Trump would love to bomb Iran, but anyway, he can't because he promised not to do any wars.
Yeah.
If anything, it's looking like they're more likely to actually withdraw troops from Iraq on the back of this rather than be going further in. And as a Jacksonian president, he simply doesn't start wars unless it's World War III.
Yep. Interesting.
It's not, you know, his base, if you like, is not up for it. Complicated by plane shot down. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Those things wash out.
Yeah, so the only thing I'm keeping an eye on, but I think you should be watching, is just those, if those protests get any bigger and start to spread to other areas of the country. I don't think they will, but but if they do, it's quite possible they will. Is that then you start saying, well, does then Iran need to crack down and other things? You know, you start spiraling back in a different direction.
Yep.
But I think there was initially a lot of you know, given the death of the general, there was initially a big outpouring towards the Iranian regime, which was having a few problems
absolutely ongoing protests. Yep.
And then it comes out, hey, we shot a passenger plane out of the sky and killed all these people, innocent people, and then the protests have sort of flared up again. So they've sort of gone from potentially this being a positive for the regime in a way,
yep,
to back to where they started from.
Yep. Yep.
I mean, probably in terms of markets, the most important thing was how little impact it had on oil. And it's continued to fall since.
Yep.
I mean, WTI is back in the 50s and falling. And, you know, that story is unchanged. Like, despite the US rig count coming off pretty substantially over the last 12 months because the oil price had been wallowing, you know, around 50, 55, US production just continues to boom. Like the shalers have been tapping this enormous inventory of untapped wells, and productivity's been booming in the wells as well.
Yep.
And so I think they passed 13 million barrels per day yesterday or something. It was out with the EIA. And so, you know, there's just an intractable oil glut.
OPEC's
got nearly, 4 million barrels per day offline.
And so, in a way, when you're keeping, you know, if the oil price is whatever $3, $4, $5 higher than it would have otherwise been, because of sort of Iranian tensions, that just means more oil gets pumped because exactly.
Yeah.
The drillers in the US are more than happy to take it and sell it.
Yeah.
So so we sort of.
But if oil is so well supplied that it can survive this kind of ruction. Then the inflation outlook for the globe is weak.
Okay. Yep.
So that buys into you know, ongoing bond market bid.
I saw once again reading probably too much press over the holidays, but there was some US shalers starting to throw their hands up in the air saying that they're going to go bang. And I know we've spoken about this many times in the past in some of our more oil centric podcasts, but from memory.
So when you say go bang,
current oil price, they're basically forward estimates is negative. They're not going to make any money.
Yep.
And from memory, that sparks perhaps some problems in the bond market, corporate US bond market. Yeah, are we seeing a bit of a tipping point there as the oil price burn out shale?
Because the prices have risen since. Okay. So it's an issue if prices go lower.
Yep.
They really have to get in deeper into the 40s.
Okay.
To cause any kind of junk bond problem in the US. And in fact, the junk bond market's been rallying in the US and emerging markets globally.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for that.
Yeah.
We'll jump across to the US-China trade deal. So we've had a little bit of very recent news, potentially positive, but prior to that, over Christmas, it was quiet.
Well, if you have a look at this tile that we've got here, this is pretty much the deal as we know it.
Yeah.
Like three lines. It's pretty much a blank piece of paper. We're not sure what's in it. It seems very vague. China doesn't want to release any details. You know, there are some some folks are putting a very positive spin on it. People who whose view I think is worth listening to, Steve Bannon, Cole Bass, etc. And I mean, it really depends how you frame the question, whether or not the deal is useful. It doesn't appear economically useful in the short term. It's certainly been useful to markets and sentiment. I think it's somewhat useful in terms of Cold War 2.0, like in terms of the US making progress on that front. It's somewhat useful. But that's not really the deal so much as the fact that they confronted them in the first place. So other than markets and obviously the huge bounce that we've seen, sentiment driven, don't see it having much economic impact. A little bit at the margin for the US with the increased exports to China.
Yep.
Don't see it changing the Chinese external account
at all.
Currency
movements?
And
no.
And most of the things they're buying are tradable goods. So whether it's oil or gas or whatever it is, where it doesn't really matter. China will buy from the US rather than buying from, you know, somewhere in the Middle East, and the stuff in the Middle East will end up going to Europe rather than going to
That's right. Around. Some have been speculating that Australia will take a hit on LNG.
Yeah, okay.
And that might impact the dollar. Don't really buy that for that reason. It's just fungible. I mean, the LNG will still go out and it'll just go somewhere else.
Yep.
It won't be it will probably be price negative, insofar as it might draw out some more US gas that wasn't necessarily viable.
Mm-hmm.
And then the displaced gas will go somewhere else, etc. So, you know, you'll get some shifts between contracts and spot markets. And
yeah. And you might get another export terminal or two built that wouldn't have otherwise been built, for a bit more certainty under supply.
But net, it's not a big deal for Australian LNG, I don't think.
There's enough fundamental problems with that.
The deal is not a big deal.
Well,
the big deal is not a big deal. Well,
it's sort of the old two steps forward, one step back, just waiting for the reneg at the end of the week or something, or, you know, it's a bit of a wobble.
Well, they've sort of both agreed that they'll keep talking again and after the election, pretty much.
Yep.
Sort of
like, and the tech stuff has never gone away.
Hmm.
It's getting worse.
Yep.
You know, US is still bashing Huawei and, you know, bashing anyone else that wants to deal with Huawei.
Mm.
UK's under a lot of pressure. They're resisting for now. But and Europe, you know, has been climbing into that as well, really on the US side.
Yep.
So, you know, I mean, probably the longest term impact from it is simply that the US did it at all.
Yep.
You know, that took them on with tariffs. And that's going to deter a lot of investment in China over time.
Mm-hmm.
And then the deal, you know, doesn't really change that, I don't think.
Oh, interesting. Well, stay tuned for the next iteation of the US-China trade war.
The great soap opera.
We'll jump across to the Chinese influence in Taiwan and Hong Kong, kicking off with Taiwan. Thoughts, gentlemen? A big win for pro-democracy, Damien, Taiwan.
Yeah, so I think for me, the interesting factors that come out of it is there's been a lot of talk of what's been happening in terms of whether it's social media or propaganda or, China funding of opposition candidates and a whole bunch of sort of behind the scenes
general meddling
that's going on. Yep. And I think the big win, the record sort of numbers and big pushback sort of shows, you know, the limit to propaganda, and that if it's out in the sunlight, it becomes way less effective.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you've also got quite educated populations, that there's more pushback as well. And so I think it's going to be a bit of a wake up for China in terms of changing it has to change something.
Yep.
It thinks Taiwan should be part of its country. It's been actively pushing countries around the world to not recognize it.
Mm.
And I think there's a I think they'll have to change what they're doing, because what they're doing is obviously not working. And that's the point. Well, that's the part where it is, you know, a big unknown and a risk, yep, in terms of what, you know, how they want to escalate it from here.
Well, it's kind of working before Hong Kong, a little.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they just go back to thin slicing the sausage, don't they, and just
chipping away
at it. And, you know, they're not in a position. Well, there's no need for them to try and take Taiwan at this point. I think the danger comes as their economy slows and, you know, the Communist Party risks losing its social contract with Chinese middle classes and over the next kind of 10 years. And then it tries to stoke, you know, nationalism.
Yeah, show of power, show of force or something.
Yeah. And, you know, and it, by then it has, say, 5 or 6 aircraft carriers or whatever. And, you know, in some ways it's a match for the US militarily, at least in terms of the South China Sea. And, you know, maybe then it makes sense in terms of the just the raw power calculus of staying top dog. And probably similar in Hong Kong.
Yeah, we've got there the next West Bank or Gaza Strip. So elaborate on that.
Basically, you know, it's an interesting viewpoint. It's not from a Chinese political scholar who's basically sort of saying, well, it's probably a good thing if it ends up being a bunch of Hong Kong kids throwing rocks at police and tanks and stuff like that, and there's sort of this low level unrest, but that sort of just ongoing, but never actually really spreads into something bigger or never actually spreads to the rest of China, then from China's perspective, that's probably about what, you know, as good as what you can expect from Hong Kong.
Okay.
So they have also fired the key one of the most senior Chinese officials there, the head of the liaison office, and appointed a new one just within the start of the new year. And so that does sort of... you know, leave some scope for a change, and maybe Carrie Lam will. You know, there's always a potential there that she might step down. I think that, you know, that if they appointed a new head of liaison, Carrie Lam stepped down. They basically didn't do any more thin slicing for a little bit until things calmed down a bit, and then commenced the thin slicing is probably what you'd think a rational response would be.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, you could probably conclude that sometime late last year, Xi Jinping realised he'd overreached.
You think? Yeah.
Well, pivoted on the trade deal. And he didn't invade Hong Kong and started making some sort of noises about minor compromises. And so I would expect Taiwan will embolden the Hong Kong protesters, you would think. So I don't expect it to go away. But will it come to a head in the year ahead? Can't say.
Probably not in the short. We've got Chinese New Year coming up in a couple of weeks as well.
I mean, I would, the West Bank Gaza Strip stuff, it's not a bad analogy. I mean, you don't want to get caught up in the granularity of that. It's not about, you know, the poverty that we see in some of the Palestinian territories. It's about how a satellite area of unrest can be managed in terms of a greater population. So I think Hong Kong just kind of bleeds on.
Well, you've probably got this thing where the university student of today is the indentured, you know, employee with a mortgage of tomorrow. So if you give it 5 or 8 years, then they run out of free time to protest, and that moves on to the next generation's problem, perhaps.
Well, don't forget the Chinese security forces are in there big time as well, and they're arresting people left, right, and centre. So that's the sort of thin slicing argument where they just slowly try and hollow out protests. That said, you know, it is kind of do or die for Hong Kong at this point. So and if you've got to do that carefully, otherwise the rebellion just grows. So, you know, an uncomfortable level of ongoing unrest in Hong Kong, emboldened by Taiwan.
Okay, very good.
Yeah,
we'll jump across now to the investment outlook Let's kick off with some stock valuations. We spoke a lot about stock valuations and market valuations last week, Damien.
Yeah, so. I've just popped two charts up. One that we had in there last week, just sort of showing that the forward earnings in the US versus the S&P index, and basically, you know, if earnings go up, then the index goes up is sort of generally the rule. I think certainly over the last sort of 6 to 9 months, earnings have been going sideways, and the market has risen quite dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and sometimes in the past, that's a sign that there's all this earnings growth about to come. We're struggling to see it. The latest data we've got out now, I've put on the chart on the right, just sort of showing the S&P forward earnings and then the Australian forward earnings as well, and just showing, well, there's no real recovery in the S&P. The Aussie forward earnings, there's a bit of a recovery, but that's off a low base, and that's mainly some of the commodities,
okay,
on higher iron ore prices. But so, you know, it is still very hard to see, buying 19 times earnings. So really paying up for companies at the moment, but you're really just not seeing any of that earnings growth at the aggregate level. At individual companies, you know, it is a different story, and we've seen
parts.
Yeah, and as you go through some of the names in there, but again, some of those ones where, you know, Apple, which is sort of one of our biggest holdings, is up sort of 100% over the last year, and it's getting to the stage where, you know, it was sort of moderately, it's about average valuation,
yep,
a year ago, and now it's starting to get well, and now it's starting to get pretty expensive.
Yep.
So even though earnings growth has been decent for it, but it's that type of thing, you just need to keep coming back and going, well,
Would I still buy it?
Mm. Do I need to start taking a bit off the top? And those types of factors. And that goes through most of the tech sector. So the places where you are seeing the growth, you're getting dramatic share price performance.
Yep.
But in aggregate across the entire US market, you're really not seeing any of that growth and any earnings growth.
A
couple of things here. So obviously, with the ASX hit an all-time high today, 7,000. Do you feel that this year might be the year of the earnings miss, perhaps? Are people paying too much, and is that going to be an issue going forward for the local market?
Oh, definitely.
Yep.
Yeah.
A few people come out talking about this.
Yeah, and some of the, talking about Apple going up, but there's some stocks in Australia which, Apple's a very high quality stock, but there's some stocks in Australia which are of similar high quality. So say a CSL, which is sort of trading on 50 times earnings last year, and 40 something times this year.
Yep.
Sort of the forecast. There are some other upsides that, you can see where that coming through, but you're really having to pay up for Australian companies.
Mm.
And the thing for Australian companies as well, so Australia's not that much cheaper than the US with way worse growth. And the other thing is where Australia is very heavily weighted towards banks and resources, which tend to be low PE sectors.
Yep, okay.
So ordinarily you'd expect that Australia should trade at a big discount just because of the makeup of the companies.
Yep.
So you're happy to pay higher multiples for companies that are safe and high quality and secure. Resources and banks tend not to be put in that category.
Boat. Yeah, right.
And so, so Australian companies just look incredibly expensive for the growth that you can see, and the economic outlook. It's very hard to tie together where
it's all going to come from. Yep. Okay.
Yeah. Very good. I mean, the key, I think, is bond yields. Like they have to remain low, or they can't go on.
Mm.
That's the equity risk premium that's driving it, I think. So, the good news for those who believe in it is that, the outlook for inflation is still very weak.
Yep.
Both here and globally. You've got US wages coming off, only a sluggish recovery in Europe. China's going to keep slowing, and Australia is operating at stall speed. So, as long as bond yields stay low, there's some hope that thing can persist.
Okay. And so for us remaining underweight Australia, just as a little wrap-up of our asset allocation for
absolutely.
The minute.
Underweight Australia, overweight, or slightly overweight, international equities, but net effect on equities is underweight.
Because
I think that the thing is, there's no immediate, we didn't look at any of these crises that we spoke about as being like an immediate catalyst for markets to fall.
Yep.
We did take advantage of sort of buying some bonds as the yields sort of rose, and that's sort of, and then they've come back, driven back down to the levels now where we're sort of not that keen to be still buying. We're happy to hold, but we're not keen to be out there buying more.
Sure.
I think there's a you know, the worsening fundamentals we think will become more obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And the next, you know, we've got reporting season coming up in the next month or so.
Yep.
So that'll be sort of pretty key. Mm. And then a little bit of daylight before we see the next sort of set of earnings to really judge how things are going. So we're probably thinking more later on in the year, as more evidence comes of the fundamentals weakening, that you'll see more weakness.
Yep. Okay. Thanks. Great answer. And just finally, Aussie and US dollar, obviously floating around with 669, was it today?
Roughly 69.
Short to medium term.
It's just been floating. Well, it's been floating up with the whole global reflation hope.
Yep.
Along with the trade deal and a bit of post Brexit.
Yep.
Etc. You know, that might have a little bit more left in it, as long as bond yields are low and globally. And you know, when markets take it in their heads that the globe's going to recover, the US dollar tends to fall.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a bit of upside for the Aussie dollar.
Mm-hmm.
But I think as the Australian ongoing Australian malaise becomes apparent. And the RBA is forced to act again,
mm-hmm.
a couple of cuts and QE sometime this year, then the Aussie rolls. And I expect that will probably coincide with, more repairs to the supply side of the iron ore market and falling iron ore prices, making our income woes worse. So I would expect the Aussie, you know, could going to have a little more upside, but I'd expect it to roll sometime this year and head lower again.
Okay. All right. Fantastic. Well, on that note, good finishing point there and segues nicely into our guests coming up next week. So we've got Dr. Stephen Hale, who is a lecturer at the School of Economics for the University of Melbourne. We're going to be having a chat to him. He specialises in modern monetary theory, or some people call it magical monetary theory, and I think it ties in quite nicely to our viewpoints for the RBA for the next 12 months. So we're looking forward to that. Same bat time, same bat channel, Thursday the 23rd of January, and you can head over to the Nucleus Wealth Live webinar page and have your answers, or your questions rather, answered live, and we'll see you there.
Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe, give us your email address, and in return we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you with the next one. Cheers.